So Mark's talk really gave kind of a good motivation for what our group is doing, and that is trying to figure out how can you make a coarse grain model that accurately reproduces structure for complicated systems. And our group's work has kind of been focusing, so I'm at Penn State, I've been there now for 5 years, and one of the motivating questions is trying to answer exactly that question. How can you take structural information for a complicated system and use that structural information to devise a coarse grain model that accurately reproduces that structure? So how does structure determine potential, and then vice versa? And before going further, I'd like to acknowledge my group. Wayne Mullinax did a lot of the things setting up the work in our group. He's moved on now, and Joe Rudzinski, who's actually an undergraduate student here, some of you know, has continued that work along with Chris Ellis and Tommy Foley, who actually worked with Scott Shell as an undergrad. He's also now in my group. And this is funded by the NSF and also by the Alfred P. Sloan Research Foundation, and recently by a Camille Dreyfus Teacher Scholar Award. So that was very the motivating question that kind of started our group's work is going back to an old question in the field of coarse graining biomolecular systems that was suggested by Tanaka and Chiraga. And at the time, people were starting to try to develop coarse grain protein models. And the obvious question, well, so people started doing this, and they got a whole bunch of exciting results. And then there was a paper published in PNAS that said, basically, this is all garbage. All these models generate things that crumple into strange structures. And if you don't look at them very closely, sure, they look like a folded protein. But if you look at them more closely, you realize that this is just arbitrary nonsense. So that was basically the title of their paper. And so that motivated, that in some sense actually killed a lot of the coarse graining work for a long time. And it was only in the 90s that people started coming back to coarse grain models again. And initially, people started thinking about coarse grain models as being toys, I think, largely, along the lines of what Marcus's group has done so well, and other groups as well, of course. Just trying to take a generic toy model and see how much can you learn from that. And that still motivates a lot of work. But I'd say in the last 15 or 20 years, there's been a resurgence in interest in trying to make coarse grain models that are structurally accurate, that go beyond just capturing generic properties of a molecular system, and trying to have them chemically specific, as some people would say. And so that kind of motivated the question by Tanaka and Chiraga. They said, one way to try to get this information is to look at experimentally determined structures, and that's obviously tremendously appealing. And in 76, the protein data bank was just coming online, and they said, let's look at that and see what we can get. And so that's motivated a tremendous body of work under the heading of knowledge-based methods. But it's well known within the field that knowledge-based models are all actually empirical, and that there are really fundamental problems in how these potentials are determined from protein structures. And two of those fundamental problems are the two problems that motivated our initial work. The first question is, if somebody gives you a collection of structures sampled from equilibrium, can you take those structures and determine the underlying potential directly? So lots of coarse graining methods rely upon iteration. You guess a potential, you simulate it, you compare it with the structure, and you go back and forth trying to refine your potential. And that's a great way. But another one might like to go directly from structures to potentials, and no one had been able to do that. No one had been able to go from a structure of even a model protein and recover the underlying potential. And so that was, obviously an important aspect of Chiraga's question. That was the first question that our group had to solve. And to give you the answer, we've been able to do that, devise the first framework for going directly from structures to potentials. And then the other aspect of this is obviously another fundamental problem in the field of coarse graining, is that how can you make a coarse grain potential that works not only for a single system, but for multiple different systems? In other words, how can you make it transferable? And there was no formal framework for doing that, but we've devised one and showed that, at least in some simple cases, it allows you to have improved transferability. And in that sense, we can actually take protein, structures from multiple different proteins and combine that information to determine the potential that generated all those structures. Those are really the most exciting results in our group. But I was hoping to try to tell you a little bit about what we're doing now, because those things are actually now 2 years old. And some of you, like Marcus, keeps on running into me in various places around the country, and then he keeps on hearing the same things. But lots of you don't know me, and so I wanted to tell you, to give you some introduction to understand how we got to that point, what this is all based upon, and the foundation of our ideas and our philosophy, more or less, our framework. So I'll introduce that, And then briefly, I'll tell you how we've gone about doing force matching without forces. And recently, in the last year or so, some of the new directions that we've devised is kind of inspired by Scott's very elegant work on trying to develop an information theoretic foundation that provides a variational framework for structure-based course training. We've gone about, inspired by that, we devised a related framework for force matching, which has some interesting parallels and differences, which I found very insightful. Because as it suggests, this work kind of comes out of the work of Greg Bolz. Well, it does. That was where I was a postdoc, where everything focuses on forces. And so being able to show that you could do force matching without forces was kind of a real neat thing to me. And so being able to devise an information theoretic approach was interesting. And then the question is, how does this force-based approach compare with what people call structure-based course training? And that's another topic that our group has really been focusing on. And I think main forces really provide an important connection between structure and force-based modeling. And I don't want to hold people up for lunch, so I'm going to try to go quickly and cover the big picture. And I do want to, my motivation for all of this is to try to motivate discussion now and later. So I hope that I'll generate some questions. And really what I hope to get out of this conference as much as anything else, I'd like to articulate what I see as some of the outstanding challenges in what some might say structure-motivated course training and try to think about how one could try to address them. Okay, so to start off with, we need some language. And so this is the beginning of some formalism. And the first step in our formalism is to introduce a mapping in which we can go from an atomistic structure to a course training structure. So from an atomistic configuration, the Cartesian coordinates for all these atoms, which is denoted by little r, and the Cartesian coordinates for a set of course training sites, which I call big R. And this mapping is linear, and in the simplest case, well, in a common case, you might take the center of mass of this atomic group and replace it with a single set of Cartesian coordinates corresponding to the center of mass. Now that we've defined the mapping, in a sense, you can actually solve the problem in one slide, right? I mean, so now the question is, what is the correct course strain potential? And the correct course strain potential is immediately obvious. If you have an atomistic configuration space where you have a collection of all possible structures the atomistic model can sample, and let's suppose each of them is sampled with a Boltzmann distribution at a given temperature, according to the potential energy function, this mapping transforms each point, each atomistic structure, into a single coarse grain structure. And in our coarse grain model, if we want to model the canonical ensemble, which is what I'll focus on today, then your coarse grain model will sample this coarse grain configuration according to a Boltzmann distribution for the coarse grain potential at the given temperature. Now, because the coarse grain model has lower resolution, there is actually a volume element of atomistic configurations, a whole bunch of different atomistic structures that get mapped to the same coarse grain structure. And a straightforward consistency criterion for a coarse grain model is to require that the coarse grain model, big P, should have the same probability of sampling a given coarse grain configuration, big R, as the atomistic model has for sampling a given atomistic configuration that maps to the given coarse grain configuration. I'm calling that little p. And so in other words, the Boltzmann factor, which determines the potential for the coarse grain model, should just equal, or be proportional to, rather, the total probability for all the atomistic configurations, the total probability for this volume element that maps to this given coarse grain configuration. That's the answer. That is the coarse grain potential you want that will perfectly reproduce the atomistic structure. And this was known back in 1935 by Kirkwood, who actually points to Onsager and other people for suggesting the same thing. And Harold Chiraga's group has really emphasized this in the context of protein folding, and our group has provided a little more insight into it, perhaps. And this is called, you might think of this as a many-body free energy landscape. Notice it depends on all the coordinates of all your coarse grain sites. So it's a tremendously complicated thing. So nobody can actually calculate this. This would be like doing a 3n-dimensional free energy calculation, which is totally hopeless, right? So nobody can actually calculate this. So even though this is what everybody wants, everybody now enters into the business of approximations. Lots of approximations focus on reproducing simple structural metrics like radial distribution functions. That's not how I'm going to motivate what we're going to do. We're going to take a different approach. And we're going to take advantage of the fact that this is called the many-body potential of mean force for a quantitative rigorous mean. And the reason is that if you take this coarse grain potential that you want and define force field, the force generated by this potential on coarse grain site I and coarse grain configuration R, that equals the force on the same site in the atomistic model, averaged over all the atomistic configurations that map to the given coarse grain configuration. So in other words, if you think about a given coarse grain configuration, there's a whole bunch of different atomistic configurations that map to the same configuration. Over these atomistic configurations, the atomistic force is a random variable. The average of this random variable is equal to the mean force, and that's the force field derived by the potential mean force. So it is a potential mean force because it generates the mean force, right? I mean, that's the name is the right name. Okay, so, and I drew this as a projection for a reason that will become clear as we go on. Because you can think of one way to define a projection of a random variable is its average. Once you average a random variable, if you average it again, you get the same number. Now that is really the basis of Greg Vo's multi-scale coarse graining method. This was my contribution to the group when I was there. He defined the functional chi-squared for trial force field, F prime, so this is a trial coarse grain force field, by comparing the force on that site, on a site I, according to the trial force field, in the map representation of an atomistic configuration, with the force in the atomistic model on the same site in the atomistic configuration. You square the difference, you average over sites, you average over configurations. Now, if you're familiar with data fitting, you know that one way to find the average of a set of points is to find the point that's closest to all the points. And for that reason, you can show very easily that the many-body mean force field, which is the force field that's derived from the many-body potential mean force, gives the global minima, right? And the rest of this functional is given by the difference, a positive definite term describing the difference between the trial force field and the mean force field. So this gives you a variational framework for determining, because the mean force field is the minimum, this gives you a variational framework for determining optimal approximations to this. Or if you have a complete variational calculation, you could actually recover the many-body mean force field. And something I skipped over on the previous slide is that not only is the many-body mean force field the force field derived from the potential mean force, it is the force field that is sufficient for generating the correct distribution of configurations. If you can recover this many-body mean force field, your coarse grain model will be perfect in the sense of reproducing the distribution of configurations sampled by your atomistic model. Okay, now this is just algebra, but this has a nice geometric interpretation as well. And that is, if you think about what a force field is just a collection of vector-valued objects that specify a Cartesian force on every particle in any configuration, in any structure. And so that can be thought of as a vector in a high-dimensional vector space. This space of all possible force fields has exactly the same structure as a vector space. And so there is a space of atomistic force fields within which lies the original atomistic force field. And then there's a subspace of coarse grain force fields in which lies the many-body mean force field, the one that you want. Within this space, you can define an inner product, and you can define a metric. And because the many-body mean force field, I said, is the projection of the atomistic force field, because it's the average, you can think of it as a geometrical projection of the atomistic force field into the space of coarse grain force fields. And in fact, chi corresponds to the distance between the trial force field and the atomistic force field. So if you minimize this distance, which is what this corresponds to, minimizing this distance while being constrained to lie within the space of coarse grain force fields, you simultaneously minimize this distance and determine a potential that is optimally close, or minimal distance, from the many-body mean force field, which is the one that you want. And then you see that this equation is really nothing more than a statement of Pythagorean's theorem within the space of coarse grain force field. This squared is equal to that squared plus that squared. Okay, so this is a variational framework, a geometric and variational framework for determining an optimal approximation to the force field that we really want. So now that we've framed this as a vector space problem, we need to identify a basis set. And in most of what we do, we assume that our coarse grain model is of a relatively simple form, a molecular mechanics form. So it includes all the standard things. It includes non-bonded interactions between different pairs, it includes bonds, it includes angles and dihedrals. Now, if you're interested in developing a force field, then you calculate the negative gradient of this, and you do that by applying your gradient operator to each of these different terms. And when you do that, you first of all differentiate each term with respect to its order parameter, and that gives you a force, right, the magnitude of the force, and then you differentiate this order parameter with respect to the Cartesian coordinates. And this gives you the direction of the force. Now, the direction of the force actually corresponds to a vector in this space of coarse-grained force fields. And so when you look at this, you see a sum of different terms corresponding to different types of interactions. In each case, you see a vector corresponding to a direction of a force multiplied by the magnitude of the force, which is a scalar. And so you can see that this is immediately a basis expansion for a coarse-grained force field. Each different basis vector corresponds to the direction of the force, and the coefficient of that basis vector corresponds to the magnitude of the force. Okay, so these force functions obviously provide the same information as the given potentials, which are what we really want. So these coefficients are what we want to try to determine. Okay. Now that we have a linear expansion of our coarse-grained force field in a given basis set, that variational problem becomes a linear least squares problem, right? We just substitute it into a functional, and now we have a linear least squares problem for the force coefficients, which are what we want to solve. And that's important because linear least squares problems are one of the things that you can easily solve in a computer, and you can solve it directly. You don't have to guess and check. You just calculate it. So now what we're doing is we've defined a basis set which corresponds to a subspace of coarse-grained force fields. The many-body mean force field, which is the one that we want, probably doesn't lie in this space. But what we do, what we obtain from this variational calculation, then, is the coarse-grained force field that is spanned by our given basis set that is minimum distance from the many-body mean force field, or the geometrical projection of the many-body mean force field into the subspace spanned by our given basis set. Okay, so one way to try to project a high-dimensional vector into a low-dimensional vector space is to require that the high-dimensional vector should have the same inner product with each different basis vector as the projection into the subspace. Okay, so we define a quantity which we call B, which is the projection of the many-body mean force field, the one that we want, onto a given basis vector. We require a coarse-grained force field to have the same projection, and then we expand the coarse-grained force field in this basis set. We end up with the inner product of this basis vector with a second basis vector. We call that corresponds to a metric tensor, which we call G. The inner product in our space of coarse-grained force fields corresponds to the correlation between the forces generated on a given site between the two different interactions, right? So the metric tensor describes the correlation between the forces generated by interaction zeta and the forces generated by interaction zeta prime on a given site. In the mapped representation of each different atomistic configuration averaged over atomistic configurations. So this is simply a structural correlation function. You can calculate this directly from structures. Okay, now.
What was the z interval? What is that? What was z?
Z corresponds to, so each different basis vector corresponds to, each different basis vector corresponds to not only a direction, but, okay, so let me look at it this way. So the force function depends upon an order parameter, or the scalar variable.
Because there's a delta in the G.
Because I put in a delta in the G, right?
Okay.
So I can separate out the force at a given distance, and then there's a delta function in the basis vector, and that's why you integrate over Z. So basically, by putting in the delta function, my coefficient corresponds to the force generated by this interaction at a distance Z, or an angle z, or whatever. So that's where z comes from.
Okay.
So each different, so this corresponds to an interaction, and this corresponds to a given distance. So this is the basis vector corresponding to the interaction at a given distance. Okay, so this is a structural correlation function. Now normally when you formulate a basis set, you try to formulate a basis set that's orthogonal. But these different basis vectors correspond to different interactions. These interactions are correlated. So these inner products, these correlation functions describing the correlation between two different interactions, do not vanish in general. And so consequently, the coordinate system is skew symmetric, right? Like this. And this is actually the huge problem that has plagued basically, well, you could say the knowledge-based field, or this is why it's non-trivial to try to go directly from structures for a complex system to potentials for that complex system, because all the terms in the potential are coupled, right? If the terms were not coupled, then statistical mechanics becomes trivial. The challenge of statistical mechanics is dealing with the correlation between the different things in your potential. This metric tensor is one way to deal with that. And so you can see, if you project the many-body-mean force field onto this basis vector G1, that corresponds to B1. But because interaction 1 is correlated with interaction 2, the projection of the mean force field along this basis vector includes contributions both from this vector corresponding to this, but also this much contribution from that vector, right? So you have to, this metric tensor gives a way for you to decompose these projections of the many-body mean force field onto a direct interaction and correlated contributions. This is the key to the whole method. And there's one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, the other thing I want to say is, if you think about what this means, let's suppose that G1 corresponds to a particular non-bonded parapotential. Then B is the projection of the many-body mean force field along that parapotential. And that sounds like the parapotential mean force between the pair. So if you know a liquid state, a little liquid state theory, you know that the parapotential mean force is directly related to the radial distribution function, which is simply a structural correlation function. So you can see that this projection describes something about the probability distribution along a given degree of freedom. And so this is a way for decomposing information along that probability distribution to different contributions in a very simple, straightforward way. Okay, so far, what did I say at the beginning? I said that I wanted to do everything going from structures to potentials. And if you've been paying attention, so far I've emphasized forces. So how am I going from structures to potentials? So this is a slide that answers this question. This is a slide where the forces go away. Okay, so on the previous slide, I defined B as the projection of the mean force field onto a given basis vector. I construct my coarse grain force field to have the same projection along that basis vector. I expand the coarse grain force field, and I get a metric tensor times a coefficient. These coefficients are what we want to solve for. This is a structural correlation function. So I need to figure out another way to evaluate the left-hand side if I want to solve for these force functions. Now, the many-body mean force field, I said, is the average of the atomistic force field. So one way to calculate an average is just to calculate the average using the random fluctuating forces. And that's actually exactly what force matching does. Force matching calculates these projections by directly projecting the atomistic force field onto each different basis vector by calculating force correlation functions. But I also said that the many-body mean force field corresponds to the potential of mean force. The potential of mean force is just minus kT log of the many-body probability distribution. And if you go and look in your favorite StatMath book, there's probably some example where they have an inner product, which is, remember, an ensemble average, of a gradient of something. And you'll probably find that when they do that, what they do is they do integration by parts to take the derivative out of the integral, out of the structural correlation function. And when you do that, you end up with the derivative of a structural correlation function. So this G bar is a simple structural correlation function of a single degree of freedom. And in fact, it's closely related to the radial distribution function. So now we can calculate B from a structural correlation function, take its derivative. That gives us this. This is a structural correlation function. And so we have a closed equation, a closed linear equation for determining the forces that provide an optimal approximation to the many-body potential of mean force directly from force, directly from structure. Okay, so this is that's what we did in our group in our first couple of years. And so our first application, well, you know, there's several different applications that built up this method. But perhaps the nicest or most impressive in some sense, at least from the perspective of trying to understand knowledge-based models, is the following. Is that we took a popular toy model for proteins developed by David Thurmalai, in which a protein is represented, each amino acid is represented by a single bead. The beads can either be hydrophilic, in which case they're colored white, hydrophobic, in which case they're colored green, or neutral, which really doesn't have very much physical significance except that they generate the terms. The rules of the model are very simple. You have bond stretches, you have bond angles, you have torsions that generate local structure. And then all the interactions, all the non-bonded interactions are purely repulsive, except for the hydrophobic interactions. The hydrophobic interactions are attractive Leonard-Jones potentials that drive the formation of a hydrophobic core. Okay, so you see the green beads cluster together, the white beads go to the outside, that's supposed to be something like protein folding. So we monkeyed around a little bit with this model so that we could fold five different sequences to different geometrical structures. We generated a bunch of structures for each of these that are sampled around the folding structure. And we calculated these structural correlation functions. Okay, now the structural correlation functions for the bonds are, well, this is actually the angles, the dihedrals, and there's two different types of dihedrals. And what is calculated, okay, so what's shown here in black is the distribution from our model data bank. In red is the distribution you would get if each degree of freedom was statistically independent. And for the bonded interactions, you can see that the different degrees of freedom are relatively independent of everything else. But then when you come over here and you look at the distribution of pairs of hydrophobic sites with hydrophilic sites, or hydrophilic-hydrophilic sites, what you see is something that's totally different. For instance, if you look at the distribution of hydrophilic sites, so these are measured, distance is measured here in units of the diameter of the bead, you find that because the hydrophilic beads get driven to the surface of the protein, they're separated by a relatively large distance of three diameters here. And so if you were to just directly invert this distribution using, you know, straightforward Boltzmann inversion, if you said that the hydrophilic-hydrophilic interaction is statistically independent of all the other terms in my potential, then you could just determine the corresponding potential by taking the logarithm of this probability distribution and calculating the potential, taking the logarithm multiplying by minus kt, and that would give you the potential. And then you'd see that there's a strong long-range attraction between the pair of hydrophilic beads that pushes them to a distance of three diameters. But that would be exactly totally wrong, because I told you that the rules are that the only beads that attract each other are the hydrophobic beads. So this long-range peak in the distribution function comes as a consequence of the fact that the hydrophobic beads cluster and the hydrophilic beads are bonded to them. And this metric tensor sorts that out. And consequently, we can quantitatively recover all the different terms in this potential directly from structures in one go. Okay, so this is kind of one of our nicest proofs of concept. And also, note these were structures calculated from different systems. So we combined all these structures together in one database, which is the same thing that people in knowledge-based methods do. And so that relied upon a framework we devised for transferring, optimizing the transferability of coarse-grained models, which I don't have time to tell you about now, but I'd love to tell you if you have questions later. So in the last few minutes, I'm not going to have very much time to tell you about much more. I don't want to take up your lunch. But I'll just briefly tell you about some things that we have done since then that I'm very excited about. And as I said, one of them is very inspired by the work that Scott did here. And Scott went back to an old paper that you can't see because the podium is blocking it, by Kolbach and Leibler in 1951. And at the time, they were interested in a problem that's very closely related to coarse graining, and that is, how can you discriminate between two probability distributions? In this case, you're interested in discriminating between the atomistic probability distribution and the coarse grain probability distribution. And so they defined an information function, phi, as the logarithm of this ratio to quantify the amount of information that is available at a given point, a given configuration, for discriminating between the two probability distributions. You can see that this vanishes if the two probabilities are equal, so there's no information for discriminating the two distributions then. But it becomes very large if the distributions have a large ratio, if the ratio is large. Okay, so they define what they call the Kolbach-Leibler divergence, or the relative entropy, as the average of this information function. So Scott originally defined this as an average over the atomistic distribution, over the atomistic configuration space. Pep Espanol derived a similar relative entropy in which he defined it actually this way, and I was able to show that the two are equivalent. Right. So this is not identical, but it's equivalent to what Scott defined as the average of this information function. And if you do just a very little bit of math, so Scott showed that if you vary this relative entropy with respect to a term in your coarse grain potential, the relative entropy varies with each term in your coarse grain potential according to the difference between the atomistic distribution for that degree of freedom and the distribution along that degree of freedom generated by the coarse grain model. So obviously, the relative entropy reaches a local minima, and Scott was able to show it's a global minima, when these two distributions are equal, right? So this gives you some kind of information theoretic framework for understanding a variational approach for deriving a set of coarse grain potentials that reproduce a set of order parameters. You know, for each, right, if this becomes stationary with respect to quaternary potential 1, you didn't reproduce the atomistic distribution for that given degree of freedom. So that was a tremendous insight by Scott. Nico was able to show in this paper that you also can't see, that if you minimize the relative entropy method with Newton's method, then you actually end up with the inverse Monte Carlo method, which is another very, very nice insight. So that was kind of neat. And so I thought that was kind of amazing stuff that Scott had come up with. And so, okay, so if you think about the relative entropy functional here, I was able to show, so here's the force matching functional. Now I said that you can express this as the difference between the trial force field and the many body mean force field, which is the average of the atomistic force field. And consequently, I was able, you know, it comes out immediately, it's pretty trivial, to show that the force matching functional is actually the average of the square of the gradient of the information function, right? So whereas inverse Monte Carlo and all these structure-based methods minimize this information function, force matching minimizes the square of the gradient of that information function. So that's kind of a neat little thing. So another thing that came out of this work is that we realized that if your quaternary potential is harmonic, both of these approaches are identical. So that was kind of a neat thing. And so what we did is, you know, calculating this exactly is very complicated for a many-body distribution. So we did something, we probably published the only paper ever to coarse grain a one-dimensional system. We assume that our coarse grain probability distribution is a distribution of a single variable. If you'd like to think that this has something to do with physics, you might say this is an AFM polling coordinate or something. This is the dashed black curve is what we're calling the distribution for this one variable generated by the atomistic model. The dashed curve is the distribution that you'd get out if you assume that your coarse grain potential is harmonic, so you can only get a Gaussian. The red curve is what you get out using Scott's relative entropy approach. And the relative entropy approach makes sure that you reproduce, you know, if in this case we went up to fourth order, so we assumed the coarse grain potential was a fourth order polynomial. And so Scott's relative entropy approach makes sure that you reproduce the first four moments, which is what inverse Monte Carlo would do, is reproduce the first four moments. Force matching, on the other hand, doesn't reproduce the first four moments. And what you can see is that if you look at these, okay, so this is when the distribution is bimodal and the two peaks are close. As you start shifting these two distributions apart, the difference between the two approaches can become more dramatic. And because reproducing the first four moments, so in one extreme case, this is kind of a silly case, let's suppose that your atomistic distribution has two peaks. One of them corresponds to large x and is very broad. So this actually dominates your moments. So the relative entropy approach, or inverse Monte Carlo, is going to shift over this way to reproduce your moments. On the other hand, so notice, the relative entropy approach minimizes the average of this information. So it's going to be most selective trying to reproduce the regions that have high probability. On the other hand, and I should have said, these are probability distributions of a single variable. Force matching is sensitive to the gradient of this. So it's going to be sensitive to regions that are rapidly varying in the probability distribution. And so the force matching actually shifts over this way. So you can understand a little bit of the difference between structure-motivated and force-motivated coarse graining, in that the relative entropy is influenced by reproducing, you know, the smooth parts of this information function. And this is going to be more influenced by reproducing the rapidly varying regions of the information function, the rapidly varying regions of your probability distribution. And that's kind of, you can kind of have some hand-waving understanding of why force matching works as well as it does, because the rapidly varying regions of your probability distribution are probably going to correspond to the rapidly varying regions, well, they correspond to the rapidly varying regions of your free energy. And we know that if you reproduce the rapidly varying part of your potential, you're going to reproduce structure, right? That's what Weeks-Chandler-Anderson tells us, is that local structure is dominated by the short-range, rapidly varying regions of your potential. So this is consistent. You know, Weeks-Chandler-Anderson gives you some idea as to why force matching does as good a job of reproducing radial distribution functions as it does. Because whereas this, if you minimize this, you're guaranteed to reproduce, the atomistic probability distribution. Obviously, if you minimize this, you're enough. Okay, so it's kind of a remarkable fact. And also, I want to emphasize, relative entropy, inverse Monte Carlo, iterative Boltzmann, you can think of them all as being different ways to solve this, minimize that. But they're all iterative, right? Force matching is direct. It's kind of remarkable that it works as well as it does. And this is some insight as to why. And a couple other interesting results that I'd like to talk about with anybody who's interested in more detail. We were able to show that both the force matching and the structure-based coarse graining approaches can be formulated in, as a, very similarly as variational problems in a linear space, closely related functionals, and the basis functions in this linear space are related by differentiation. So the two different spaces over which you're doing the optimization are very closely related. We're able to generalize Henderson's uniqueness theorem. That's kind of a very popular and famous result in the field that says the potential that generates a given radial distribution function, if it exists, is unique. Nobody knows if it exists in general. And Ard and Teresa Head Gordon kind of generalized that in some extent, and we generalized that by providing conditions, sufficient conditions for this. We generalize this for any arbitrary potential energy function, any arbitrary probability distribution, and we provided conditions for the uniqueness of the potential, right? And we were able to show that actually the conditions for uniqueness in force matching and the conditions for uniqueness in structure-based coarse graining are very closely related. They're not identical, but they're very closely related. In particular, it's difficult to actually prove the uniqueness. The condition required for uniqueness of structure-based coarse graining is complicated. The condition required for uniqueness of force matching is trivial. But we could show that the uniqueness of the force matching result implies the uniqueness of the structure-based approach. We're able to generalize the force matching approach in this YBG theory to arbitrary potentials. Something that I didn't mention, when we transformed from forces to structures, we came up with an integral equation that's equivalent to what's known as the Yvonne Born-Green equation, except for now it's generalized for arbitrary complicated potentials. And whereas historically the Yvonne Born-Green equation had been thought of as an exact relationship that's direct, in other words, given a pair potential, the Yvonne Born-Green equation was an exact relationship between the resulting two and three body correlation function. We showed that this Yvonne Born-Green equation is not only exact in the direct sense, it's optimal in the inverse sense. Given a two and three body correlation function, it determines the optimal approximation to the true potential. And moreover, yeah, we generalize it to arbitrary potentials. So now we generalize these results for any type of potential. And we also were able to show a rather intriguing result about the excess entropy in atomistic and coarse grain models. And that is that there's a bound on the difference between the excess entropy of an atomistic model and a coarse grain model that reproduces the same structure. And that's really intriguing to me, and I don't think any of you can actually see it. I don't know, maybe you can see it. Anyway, it's at the bottom over there. Where it depends upon the number, this omega 1 is basically the canonical ensemble of atoms, it's the volume element of the canonical ensemble of atomistic configurations that get mapped to a given coarse grain configuration. And that provides a variational bound between the, and if your coarse grain model just throws away a bunch of degrees of freedom and keeps all the other degrees of freedom, and by, well, I'll be more, if it throws away a whole bunch of molecules and keeps all the details about other molecules, then it's trivial to show that this bound is zero. So in an implicit solvent model, this is zero. But this implies something about the loss of excess entropy between the two different representations of the same system, which is, I think, interesting in the context of thinking about phase transitions in coarse grain models. And I won't have time to tell you about this, but we're able to show that iterative Boltzmann inversion and force matching have an interesting relationship between each other, too, in terms of mean forces, but I won't have time to tell you about that. We've done a lot of calculations to understand this metric tensor. This didn't come out as well as I'd like, but we were able to understand, you know, the metric tensor is the thing that sorts out the correlation between these different basis vectors and how that is important for determining the optimal coefficients of the different basis vectors. And we're able to interpret this in terms of relatively simple molecular packing properties that are relatively generic and robust, that give, you know, that you can understand, right? So this metric tensor seems like a tremendously complicated thing. But we've been able to relate it to particular generic robust features of molecular systems. And we've also been able to rationalize how it depends upon the mapping, which is also intriguing, the Korsner representation. And we've done a whole lot of stuff with that. But so this is what I wanted to leave you with in my last few minutes. I mean, I could talk forever. Marcus has seen me do that. These are some of what I think are the outstanding challenges for structure-motivated course training. This is a slide that's probably everyone, lots of people have seen this. I think this is the cover of some kind of error analysis book, right? Probably lots of you have seen. And I usually put this picture at the beginning to motivate why it's important to make sure that your course training model reproduces is correct. You know, it's easy to make a course, anybody, you know, you can always write down a course training potential, and you can always simulate it. But if the potential doesn't have meaningful physics, you're basically running your train off of its tracks. And when Honig showed that result in 77 or something, you can look, and it just seems like that kind of really put the damper on course training for a long time. For about 10 years, I'd say. And so I think that it's important to think about, you know, where is course training going? And are we being careful thinking about whether, you know, are we being critical of what we're doing? Or on the other hand, is course grading really this train that takes you places you could never go before? Is it really taking you to the right places? Is it this futuristic way to extend length scales and time scales to study processes that are impossible to study otherwise? And I would say we're not, in my humble opinion, which maybe many of you will disagree with, but it seems to me we're not here yet. I don't think we're there, but I think if we really want to get there, we have a lot of work to do. And I think that some of these questions are the things we need to be thinking about. There are other questions too. But just in the context of trying to reproduce models, develop what we call sometimes serial course train models, developing a single resolution course train model for reproducing structure, these are some of the challenges that I think lies in the field. One is that maybe our metrics aren't good enough. Everybody wants to reproduce radial distribution functions, and that's great for liquid. If you're interested in reproducing a complex polymer or a protein, maybe we shouldn't be reproducing radial distribution functions. Now, two other questions that are closely coupled and I think tremendously important. For any mapping, there is a many-body potential mean force. That means for any mapping, there is a coarse grain potential that will reproduce the atomistic structure. But good luck finding it. At the end of the day, everybody approximates it with something, and that defines a basis set. Now, you can define an optimal approximation to the many-body potential mean force given that basis set, but maybe that optimal approximation isn't good enough. And then your only solution is to try to add terms to your potential. And what terms do we want to add that are both going to significantly improve the structure and also not tremendously destroy our efficiency? No, I don't think people really have a systematic way to deal with it. The converse problem is that in reality, everybody wants a molecular mechanics coarse grain potential. Nobody wants to simulate 4 or 5 body potentials. So your mapping, your basis set is fixed. You know, Gromax doesn't simulate 6 body potentials. So your mapping, your basis set is fixed. Then the question is, if your basis set is fixed, how can you optimize your representation of the system in such a way to get the best distance for your mapping? To make your optimal approximation as optimal as possible based upon your mapping. And we showed that actually improving the resolution of the mapping doesn't necessarily improve the results or the transferability. So that's kind of a tricky question that people haven't, I think, addressed. And that was why I was so interested in Peter's discussion. Because the challenge of trying to find good order parameters for representing a free energy function is exactly the same problem. Here we're trying to find the free energy function is the many-body potential mean force. The order parameters are the coarse grain coordinates, probably. Maybe you want to do different coordinates. But anyway, trying to figure out how to optimize these mappings is really important, and I don't think enough people have thought about it. You know, transferability is a huge issue, right? I mean, how can I make a coarse grain model that works at different temperatures, different pressures, different environments? Thermodynamics. I think someone said, I don't remember who, but structure-based coarse graining for relatively simple systems can do a really good job of reproducing radial distribution functions, and then you find that the pressure is off by 4 orders of magnitude or something. On the other hand, if you do top-down coarse graining, you can get the pressure right, and the structure is not off by 4 orders of magnitude. I don't know what that would look like, but so the question is, how can we incorporate thermodynamic properties into our coarse graining framework? I think Hans Andersen wrote a beautiful, very elegant paper that points the way to do it, and that is that we need to think more critically about the ensemble that we're trying to coarse grain in. But it's kind of tricky, and no one has really followed up on what he did, I think. And he only showed this works for Leonard Jones' system, which is not obviously the most exciting system to think about. And this issue about what happens to the entropy in your coarse grain model, what does that mean for where the phase transitions go? That's the question that we need to ask. Another question is, what are we going to do with the solvent, I think? If you throw away the solvent in a protein simulation, you immediately throw away 90% of your atoms, or something like that. So your simulation immediately becomes 10 times faster right there, something like that. But can we do that? Do we need explicit solvent in our coarse grain models? Or can we be more clever about implicit solvent coarse grain models? I mean, it's easy to formally integrate out the solvent, and it's easy, I'd say, to reproduce some things when you've integrated out the solvent, but other things are really hard to reproduce. I think the grand, one of the huge goals is to try to figure out how to devise coarse grain models without simulating your system. First, with an atomistic model, can you use experimental data? I mean, this is why I think the protein data bank is such an intriguing idea, these knowledge-based methods. Or can we just use theory to determine these potentials? And I'd say that that's hopeless, right? I mean, that's the outstanding problem in statistical mechanics. So that's kind of a very impossible problem. I think we need to think about trying to devise a priori error bounds and how predictive can our coarse grain models be. Scott did some really nice work showing that you can think about the relative entropy as a way for predicting possible errors in your coarse grain model a priori, and I think that's kind of an exciting thing to think about. What are we really trying to get out of this? What do we want with our coarse grain models? I think lots of people want coarse grain amber. I mean, they want to be able to make here are the Leonard Jones parameters for alanine in your coarse grain model and so on and so forth. That's what people want, and the Martini model is a tremendously successful and important step in that direction, but it doesn't fold proteins, and that's what people want. So are we moving in that direction? Do we want to move in that direction? Is that even what coarse grain modeling is for? And then, I think it's time for lunch, right? So, when we think about lunch, what do we want, and is it possible to get? I've heard several times people allude to the no free lunch theorem. I don't really think I need a free lunch, but I want to know is, does lunch exist, and how much does it cost? If I could think about a coarse grain model, I'd be willing to do a lot of, if I knew that it existed, if I knew that a coarse grain model had certain properties, I'd be willing to expend a lot of effort to get it. But is it possible? And how much effort is necessary? I mean, I think those are questions that the field really needs to think about. Anyway, so thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much for your tour de force, and your list of topics certainly will keep us busy beyond the 6 weeks we are still here.